Hi, I'm Destiny. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is August 29th of 2000. And I have a sponsor in a home group. And Billy, thank you so much for asking me to come out again. It's definitely an honor. And I guess I'll just get to it. I'll tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, I grew up in Washington, D.C. I was adopted at birth into a very loving family. You know, I grew up with two wonderful parents and a younger brother, and I really never wanted for anything growing up. You know, I had a great childhood, you know, but I just, you know, from an early age, just didn't feel right, you know, and of course I didn't know that then, but I mean, some of my earliest memories were, you know, being jealous of someone in school who had, you know, cuter clothes than me or prettier hair than me. You know, those are some of my earliest memories from, like, kindergarten. And that's just kind of how I was as a kid. And I definitely was a kid that was full of fear. I had lots of nightmares growing up and would have panic attacks about dying and just very full of fear. I was claustrophobic, all sorts of stuff. Not normal fears, I would think, you know, for a 4 or 5, 6-year-old child. And my parents definitely knew that there was something not right about me. And, you know, from a very early age, I remember seeing specialists and doctors and having a lot of testing done, you know, looking at the ink blots and, you know, telling them what I saw and things like that. You know, and obviously I'd never taken a drink of alcohol or anything like that at that point, but I just felt like I was a kid that was maladjusted to life, you know, and I couldn't have said that to you, but that's definitely looking back, you know, how I felt growing up, just kind of not right. And, you know, and I went, started elementary school, and I would switch schools every 3 years, and that became a pattern throughout. As long as I've been in school, I would pretty much switch schools every 3 years, thinking the school is the problem, the teachers are the problem, the kids were the problem. You know, if I went somewhere else, I could have a fresh start, and things would be good, and I would do that every 3 years. You know, so I started at another school in fifth grade, and things just kind of went bad. You know, I started to feel really depressed all the time. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't want to get out of bed. I didn't want to really do anything. And my parents started to get worried yet again, and eventually I started to feel suicidal and you know, started to do things to harm myself. And my parents started to send me to psychiatrists and therapists and to try and figure out what's wrong with me. And I got diagnosed with a bunch of different things, put on a bunch of different medications, you know, told that if I went to therapy and took these pills that I would be okay. And I did that, and I didn't feel okay. And around that time, you know, I started to sneak into my parents' liquor cabinet and take shots of liquor. And, you know, my parents are normal. You know, they're not alcoholic. They don't have a problem with drinking. They probably drink more than maybe the average normal drinker. They really love to entertain. That's has always been a huge part of their life, something that they really enjoy doing. So they probably drink on more of a regular basis than maybe some, but completely normal. You know, I knew growing up, you know, alcohol was for adults, not for, you know, 10, 11-year-olds. But, you know, I did always have a strange fascination, you know, with alcohol. You know, and I loved looking at the liquor bottles. I loved smelling all the different liquors from a young age. I loved it when I would get a sip of beer or wine from my parents, you know, but nothing more than that. But somewhere around fifth grade, I think, I was 10 or 11 years old, and for whatever reason, I thought it would be a good idea to take a shot of peach liqueur, which tasted the best to me at that time, you know, when I felt anxious or I felt scared, it just seemed like what I should do. So I would do that. I would take a shot, and it would make me feel better. And I usually would only take like one or two because I knew that I shouldn't be drinking. Like, that's not what a 10 or 11 year old does. You know, and then I would clean out the shot glass and like hide it in the back of the cabinet. Like, my parents would even think that I was drinking in the first place, but that's what I would do. And I did that for a while, off and on. You know, whenever I would feel that anxious feeling, that tight feeling in my chest, or I would feel afraid about something, I would just go and take a shot, and it would make me feel better. And, you know, so I was taking all these medications, you know, pretty much hating my life and really having absolutely no reason to hate it. There's nothing I could point my finger to, why my life felt so miserable. You know, but I just felt like I didn't fit in with my peers. You know, I felt so much like I just wanted to be accepted. I just wanted to be liked. And I felt like no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't quite get there. And I always kind of felt like I was on the outside looking in, and just wanted to feel what it looked like other people had. You know, I would look at other people, and it seemed like, you know, they had these great lives, they had these friends, you know, they did well in school, they enjoyed their life, you know, and I did not feel that way on the inside. You know, and so, you know, and I also thought, you know, for a long time that, you know, I felt the way I felt because I was adopted. And I thought that, you know, if you didn't grow up with your birth parents and you couldn't look at your parents and see yourself and understand why you felt so different on the inside, you know, then you would have all these problems too. And I felt that way for a long time. And, you know, so once I got to ninth grade, I switched schools again thinking I could have a fresh start, and, you know, I could make myself into whatever I wanted to be, and it would be different. And, of course, it wasn't. It was the same old, same old. And, you know, and I just felt more and more uncomfortable in my own skin and hated my life more and more. And I started to have different groups of friends. You know, I would have my good friends, you know, that were doing the right thing and, you know, going to class and doing their work. And then I had my other set of friends that, you know, had body piercings and tattoos and, you know, big chain wallets and dark makeup and all that, and who would skip school, like the bad kids, and I would hang out with them. And so I was kind of having that double life where I could try to keep up appearances with my family, like, oh, these are the friends I'm bringing home, and then I would go hang out with these other people. And once I got into 10th grade and I turned 16, that's when I got drunk for the first time. And I remember I went to my friend's house, and she just had, you know, there's like 7 people there, and you know, we were just having a little get-together, and somebody brought alcohol. And, you know, and obviously I'd had those sips of wine and beer, and I'd taken those shots when I'd felt anxious or afraid. But other than that, I'd not really done a whole lot with alcohol. And, you know, and I got my own bottle of alcohol, and it was like St. Ives Special Brew, so it tasted like fruit punch. And I drank it down, and I got drunk, and I had a great time. You know, I felt okay, you know, and from feeling so anxious and full of fear and just self-loathing, self-hatred, you know, not feeling like I fit in, just wanting to, like, hide under my covers and not deal with life most days, you know, I felt so good. I felt like I could smile. I felt like I could have fun. I could talk to people. I wasn't worried about what you thought about me, which I worried about all the time. Or, you know, am I going to say the right thing or act the right way? I just had a fun night, and I laughed with my friends, and I felt like I was the life of the party, and it was great. And, and I didn't start drinking every day or anything like that, but, I started to drink at every opportunity I could find. You know, anytime there was a party or a get-together, I was there ready to drink, and that's what I did for a while, and I started to get into some other things, some drugs and whatever, as well, and I started to skip school a lot. I just didn't see the point in going, when I could go hang out with my friends and get drunk or, do whatever. So I would do that, and I would skip school for weeks at a time and then forge, sick notes or whatever. I don't know what I was thinking, but I missed like half of my school year. And I also, started to get into some heavier drugs, and start to kind of go downhill with that whole thing. And also at that time, partway, I think it was in May of that year, my sophomore year, I got in touch with my birth mother for the first time. And I had written her, I had found a letter that she had sent to my parents. And I didn't tell my parents that I had found it. And I sent her a letter. And I wasn't I didn't know what I was expecting. I didn't know if she even cared or wanted to see me or anything. So I kind of wrote the letter and then put it out of my mind. And like 3 days later, my parents set me down at the dinner table. And they were like, your birth mother called. She got your letter. And I was like, oh, no. I thought I was, like, in big trouble. So, because my parents, this was not really a subject they like to talk about. They told me that she had called and gotten my letter and that, she really wanted to meet me. And I felt overwhelmed and excited with all of that. And then at the same time, it just so happened that my sister happened to be in D.C., at that time, so I actually got to meet my sister that night. So it was kind of a crazy time. I was like drinking, doing drugs, skipping school, like meeting my sister, soon to meet my birth mom, and so all of that was going on. And I met my birth mom maybe like a couple weeks later, and she was everything that I had kind of dreamed that she would be. She was young, she was beautiful, she was cool, and she smoked pot, and I thought that was awesome. And so I proceeded in that, week that she came to visit me, take her from party to party to party, like, and just, like, get wasted with my mom. I just thought like that was the coolest thing ever, and a couple months after that, I had gotten to a point with some other stuff that I was doing where I was becoming addicted and not really able to function at all, keep up any sort of appearance, and I ended up having to get some help for that. And my parents were so angry with me and so frightened for me. And I just felt like, whatever, I get a 2-week break. This is awesome, And I manipulated them into not sending me to like a rehab, but to let me go stay with my birth mom for 2 weeks. So I went there and spent 2 weeks with her and just got wasted the whole time, and came back and I was like, I'm good, and just kept on doing the same thing, skipping school, getting drunk and high whenever I could, and when I was 18, I moved to Vermont to live with her, and I thought that if I could live with her, then I could figure out what was wrong with me, and that was kind of a theme in my life. I years into sobriety, I had to go back over my first step, and I'll talk about that later in my story, but one of the things that my sponsor said to me after I'd never written a formal first step or anything like that, but it got to the point where I needed to, and to read it to her, and I did that, and after I read it to her, she looked at me and she said, you're a seeker. you know, I can see in your story that you were seeking, you know, what was wrong with you, you know, and you found it here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, but that was what I did. I mean, I was a seeker. I thought if I switched schools, it would be different. I thought if I switched friends, it would be different. If I went to church, it would be different. You know, therapy, I tried everything I could think of, you know, and now it was changing states. If I could live in this other place and live with my birth mom, then I could figure out what was wrong with me and live some sort of a normal life like I saw other people living. And, you know, so when I was 18, I moved in with her and I finished my senior year in Vermont. And I don't think that I really figured out what was wrong with me living with her, but it really was where my alcoholism took off, you know, because I was now in an environment where, you know, it was perfectly acceptable for me to do the things I needed to do to feel okay, you know, which was drink and get high. And, you know, I lived in a house where the shades were always drawn, and I thought it was really cool, you know. And And when I went into my senior year, I was in a magnet program in the high school I'd been in before. So I went into my senior year, you needed 100 credits to graduate, and I went in with 99. So, like, my senior year was like a joke. So, you know, I basically could drink and do drugs as much as I wanted, and I did. And I would show up to class sometimes, sometimes not, and I just kind of did whatever I wanted. And I made a few friends while I was there, but at that point, I was so full of fear all the time that I could hardly leave the house, is the truth. You know, before I moved there, I would go to parties all the time and inevitably do something humiliating or demoralizing. And I'd really started to wear on my friendships, you know, friendships that I'd had for a long time. You know, my friends were done with me. They didn't want to deal with the drama anymore of, like, what is Destiny going to do tonight? You know, what humiliating thing is she going to do? What embarrassing thing is she going to do? And, you know, and so when I moved there, I kind of had the resolve to, you know, not be like a party girl. And on the same end, I was so full of fear, I felt like I couldn't even if I wanted to. So I just, you know, drank a lot by myself, and I felt okay with that for a time. And until the loneliness got so bad that I couldn't bear it. I mean, I was having to, you know, sleep all day long, you know, because I could not bear the way I felt in my skin if I did not have something in my body to change the way I felt. And I started to feel really depressed again. And I started dating this guy a couple months after I'd moved there. And I was so desperately lonely. And I met him at a party. I was wasted. You know, however you meet your boyfriends, that's how I met mine. You know, so I met him at this party. I was completely wasted, barely remember the night, and we all of a sudden were basically, like, living together, you know, how it goes. And so I felt like at least I had him, you know, and he drank like I drank. So I was like, we're good. And, you know, and so I kind of made it through my senior year, and I don't know what I thought I was going to feel like when I graduated. Like, it was supposed to be some sense of accomplishment, but I just didn't even care at that point. You know, I just graduated, and I was like, all right, whatever. And I did get into college. I got into the University of Vermont. And, you know, so I worked the summer waiting tables and drinking. And then I went to the University of Vermont, and I thought, you know, when I went there, it's the one time in my drinking where I consciously thought I was not going to drink. And I was never a daily drinker. And I would go periods of time without drinking. And that was part of the revisiting my first step many years into sobriety, because I struggled with that fact that, you know, I was never a daily drinker. But I would go periods of time, you know, whether it be a week, 2 weeks, a month, where I wouldn't drink, you know, but I would always return to drinking, and it wouldn't even be a thought, you know. And a lot of those times, sometimes it would be I humiliated myself so badly at a party that I thought, I gotta cool it down, you know, and I wouldn't go to parties, and so I wouldn't drink until, like, you know, until something would happen and I would drink again. You know, so that was kind of a theme throughout my drinking. But this was the one time where I consciously thought to myself, I'm really gonna do something different. You know, I'm gonna go to college. I'm going to have the college experience. I'm gonna live on campus. You know, I might join, you know, some sort of group on campus, whatever that may be, I don't know, you know, but I was really going to give it my all, and I got there, and, you know, I was just so full of fear, I could not leave my dorm room, you know, and I could go to class and come back, and that's what I could do, and it was miserable, and I did that. I think I lasted maybe a week, I don't know. And I couldn't take it anymore. And so I quickly found some people who were doing what I needed to do, and I was off to the races again. And when I went into college, I didn't have a roommate. My roommate, I don't know I was supposed to have a roommate, but I didn't have a roommate. And I lived in kind of like an apartment-style living, so there was 3 bedrooms and, you know, 2 doubles and 1 single. So I didn't have a roommate. And maybe a month into school, I got a roommate, and she was this hippie girl. She had long blonde dreads down to her butt, and, you know, the whole hippie get up, and she was really cool, and, you know, she smoked a lot of pot, and, you know, I was like, this is great, you know, and her boyfriend moved from California with his 2 dogs, and they moved into our dorm room, so it was one big happy family. It was insanity, and then my boyfriend would be there, too, and his dogs were trained that if anyone came to the door, they would hide under the bed, so nobody ever knew they were there. I mean, it was like, it was insanity. I don't even know how that was pulled off, but, you know, I mean, I was off to the races, you know, drinking and getting high pretty much 24/7. And, you know, and it was great. I was like, this is great. You know, I can do this. And I made it through that semester. And somewhere in that semester, my relationship with my boyfriend started to become violent. And I kind of thought, I mean, I certainly was not raised to accept that type of treatment or behavior in any way, but something had happened to me, and I didn't care. I thought, you know, I am so lonely that I need some sort of companionship, and he is able to get me things that I would not be able to get on my own, so this is the price I have to pay for that to happen. And you know, and so that started happening, and I was like, oh, well, you know, it is what it is, and just kept on. And so I made it through that semester, and I tried to go back for my second semester, and my roommate had moved out and gone to Amsterdam, and so she was gone, and the other sweet mate that I would drink and get high with had moved back to Maine, and so I was alone again, and actually my roommate's boyfriend was still there, and he would stay in my dorm room sometimes to have a place to stay or whatever, but that was like it, and I was back to being just completely lonely and completely desperate, and I had one night where I couldn't get anything, and I was going crazy. I felt like my skin was crawling. I just couldn't stand it, and I just took a pair of scissors and just started cutting myself, and, you know, just anything to not feel what I was feeling on the inside. And so one of my sweet mates found me and, of course, was very concerned with what she saw, and rightfully talked to the RA, who talked to the dean, and I got in all this trouble, and in order to stay at school, I had to start seeing a psychiatrist and a counselor, so I was back to that again, back to being on medication again, and for whatever reason, I was honest with the psychiatrist, and I told her about my drinking and my drug use, and she told me that it was a coping mechanism for my depression, and I was like, okay, you know, I didn't know. I was like, all right, you know, and, you know, so back on the medication and all that stuff, and things just kept getting worse and worse. I could no longer get out of bed, couldn't shower, I couldn't go to class, I couldn't do anything, I was a complete disaster, and I ended up having to medically withdraw from school. And I thought, well, maybe I just wasn't ready for school. Maybe I jumped the gun, you know. Maybe I need to work. And so I got my job back waiting tables, and I started, you know, working 50, 60 hours a week waiting tables, and then, you know, getting high on my way home and drinking, you know. And I did that for and basically until I got sober, but for a while. And I was still living with my mom, and she had gotten to the point where she was done with me. I mean, she was terrified that I was going to die, and she had tried everything to help me, forcing me to, you know, go to therapy, forcing me, like, I wasn't allowed to take naps. I had to have this whole contract that she'd written up that I had to sign, that I would, like, eat a salad every day and, like, take a walk, like, all these things. I mean, she was just desperate, and she was done, and she kicked me out, and so I was homeless. I didn't think I was homeless. I don't know why I didn't think I was homeless, but I was homeless. I did not have a home. And so I had everything in my car, and I would stay place to place wherever people would let me, you know, crash for a couple days until I'd wear out my welcome. And I stayed in, like, an empty house for 2 weeks, like, slept on the floor, you know, thinking that was just fine. I mean, you know, and still working, and on my days off, I didn't have anywhere to go, so I'd break into my mom's house and watch TV and then sneak back out through the window before she came home. And so I did that for a while, and I got a phone call one day from my parents in D.C., and they had no idea any of this was going on. I mean, I certainly wasn't telling them. And they were like, "What are you doing with your life? Like, are you going to go back to school? Like, what are you doing?" And I had no answer for them at that point. And they really wanted me to come home, and I was out of answers. So I was like, all right, I'll come home. So I moved home, and it was during the summer. So all of my friends from D.C. were home for the summer. So I just started partying with them again, you know, doing the same thing. Out, you know, till 2-3 in the morning, coming home wasted or high, my mom at the kitchen table, like, terrified, not knowing where I am, screaming at me, you know, "Are you drunk? Are you high? What's going on?" And I'd just be like, "I'm just tired. I'm just, it's 3 in the morning," you know, just lying straight to her face, you know, and they were just beside themselves. They just didn't know what to do, and I thought, you know, maybe if I tried to go back to school, that would get them off my back. So I got into the University of Arizona, and I thought, you know, Vermont was really cold, lots of snow, it's hard to walk to class in a snowstorm, like, I'll go somewhere warm, you know, that was my thinking. I'll go somewhere warm, there's a lot of light, it will help with my depression, I'll be able to go to class, things will be great. And I went for orientation with my parents, and I didn't have any drugs, and I didn't have any alcohol, and I got really sick. I was shaking and throwing up, and I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't eat, and I was just miserable. And I was just so delusional. I thought it was, it must be a bad combination of medication I was taking that was just really messing up my stomach. But I mean, I was going through withdrawal, and so needless to say, I did not go to the University of Vermont or of Arizona. I made it through the orientation. I was like, I can't do this. This school is not for me. And so I was back to not really knowing what I was going to do. And a couple months earlier, my brother had been, you know, going through his drinking and drugging, and but he was living with my parents, and they sent him to this program, like, in the woods. And we went to visit him for, like, a family day. And I remember going and thinking that there was something different about him. And I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but there was something different about him. And many years earlier, when he was kind of in the height of his drinking and drugging, he had come home one day after being out all night, and I had said the wrong thing to him at the wrong time, and he started beating me up on the kitchen floor. He had me on the floor, punching me in the face, and my mom is screaming for him to stop. And we'd kind of never spoken about that again, and he actually brought that up to me. And it really struck me that he would even bring that up to me, and he kind of made amends for it. And And I left there thinking, you know, maybe I need to do something like this. Maybe I need to go somewhere where I can figure out what's wrong with me, and you know, so I can get back to my life, you know. And so my parents, you know, looked into it, and we found this program in Idaho. It wasn't a rehab or anything like that. I didn't think drinking was my problem. I thought depression was my problem, and that's why I couldn't function in life. And if I could get my depression under control, then I could go back to school and live a normal life. So I went to this program in Idaho, and it was like a program for troubled girls. And so I went there, and I detoxed there, and it was horrible, horrible. I was just a complete wreck for like a couple weeks, and then I started to feel a little physically better, and the program didn't do a whole lot for me. It did remove me from drinking and drugs, you know, so I am very grateful for that. But what they also did is they would take us to AA meetings, and I remember the first meeting I went to. You know, it was in a church basement, a very small meeting, and I remember listening to the people share, and they were sharing exactly how I felt on the inside. And I had searched for that my whole life, someone who understood how I felt on the inside. And I thought, maybe, just maybe, you know, maybe this is what I have, you know. But that was such a powerful experience. I was like, I have to go back to these. I have to go back. And, you know, and so I started to go to more and more and more meetings. You know, it went from a couple a week to once a day to twice a day to hanging out with sober people, you know, going to the noon meeting, hanging out with sober people, having lunch, going to the night meeting, going to the diner, you know. And I was just so happy to, like, have people to hang out with. You know, I did not care. I didn't care if you were older than me. I didn't care if you were younger than me. I was just happy to, like, have nice people who understood how I felt, you know. And I eventually got a sponsor, and she was a wonderful sponsor. And she really put me in her back pocket and took care of me and spent a lot of time with me and started to take me through the book. And after about 6 months, there were some stuff. The meetings that I went to, there were great meetings, but there was not a lot of unity, and some stuff had happened, and my sponsor called me one day and said, I think it's time for you to go home. And I was like, okay. She's like, I think I'm afraid for your sobriety. You know, you're so new, and I think, you know, it's time. And I was like, okay. And so I moved back home, and I took the train home because I was too afraid to fly. I was just so full of fear. I was afraid to fly, afraid to be in cars, everything. So I took the train home, and it took like 3 or 4 days, and didn't go to a meeting. And I got home and didn't go to a meeting because I was too afraid to call anybody that I didn't know, and I was too afraid to go to a meeting by myself. You know, I was still really full of fear. And within, I don't know, 5 days, I found myself sitting on the front porch of my house with my mom's office manager, who was drunk, drinking wine, and I was telling her how I wasn't an alcoholic, I was just an addict, and I could drink if I wanted to. And it happened that fast, 5 days, you know, no meeting. And before I actually came back, my mom had met this woman who knew about this young people's group, and she gave me the number of this guy, Jake, and I finally, after that, gave him a call, and he didn't answer. I left him a message, and he didn't call back. I didn't know at the time that he had just drank, but what he did do is he called someone in AA, and he called Kevin, and Kevin called Bridget, and Bridget called me, and thank God, because I would not be here speaking if that had not happened. You know, that is certainly a loving God, you know, one of many, many examples of a God in my life, for sure. And she called me and picked me up for a meeting, and the first thing I said when I got in the car was, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm an addict. And she's like, that's cool, get in, let's go to the meeting. And thank God, you know, thank God. And she took me to a meeting, and it was a Friday night meeting in Virginia, and it was bright and shiny, and there was tons of people there, and they looked happy, and they'd showered, and, you know, shiny, all of that stuff. I was still not that good at it at that point, you know, and I thought, okay, maybe I can do this, you know, maybe I can do this, and I just got swept up, you know, I really got swept up by the members of my home group. You know, like I've heard so many other people share, I mean, people surrounded me. They asked my name, how long I've been sober, if I had plans the next day. And, you know, and I really needed that because I was so full of fear still. And, you know, and I just jumped in, you know, and started getting busy. And I got, you know, Bridget, the woman who picked me up, to be my sponsor. She's been my sponsor for almost 10 years now. And, you know, and I really started, you know, to just jump into the program and get busy, and things got really good. You know, I got back into school and started going to school, and I got my own apartment with some, you know, friends in the program, and, you know, and I was healthier, and all that stuff. Like, a lot of outside things started to happen, started to change for me, and what happened as a result of that, and those are all great things, you know, but what happened as a result of that is, you know, I started to feel better. So I thought, I don't really need to do everything that the program requires, you know. And on the same end, I still questioned my first step. I really did. And if you question your first step and don't think that you have to do everything that we do, then, you know, you're not really going to grow too much. And that's what happened to me. And I, you know, it's like I got back into school. I got some friends. You know, my parents were a little bit happier with me. And I got a boyfriend. And I thought, I'm good. You know, I'm good. And I would go to a meeting every day. And I would call my sponsor and check in. I really wasn't able to see too much of myself at that point. I would do service when it was convenient for me. You know, if I, you know, if someone else would see me doing the service, I would do it, or, you know, whatever. But I definitely would pick and choose, for sure. And I did that for a long time, for many years, actually, in sobriety. And I did a fourth and a fifth step at 9 months, and I was as searching and fearless as I could have been at 9 months. And, you know, and I read that to my sponsor, and I just kind of was like, and we're good, you know. And I kind of really just sought outside things to make me feel better. You know, I really thought that if I could just get all my ducks in a row, you know, if I could have my life look how I wanted it to look, then I could get to the business of, you know, sobriety and the steps and recovery. And that's really what I thought. And it talks about that in the 6 and 7 step, you know, which that 6 and 7 step hit me hard when it hit me. You know, so I lived like that for a while, and I didn't grow, is the truth, you know, and I continued to cause damage with my family. I would use AA as my excuse for why I couldn't show up for things, and I did not show up for things. I would show up if I felt like it, but most of the time I didn't, and I was still very much a taker in that relationship. And what happened was, is that at 6 years of sobriety, I found myself more miserable than I'd ever been. And I had started a new job, and I graduated college. I'd started a new job. I was ill prepared for the real world, to say the least. And I felt like I was tired all the time, stressed out, full of all that fear again of like new people, new situation, didn't know what I was doing. I would make it till Thursday and have a hysterical breakdown, sometimes not even be able to make it to work. I started to skip meetings because I was so tired. I mean, if you were as tired as I was, you would need to stay home and get some sleep. You know, I have to go to work. That was my justification. And I stopped being honest with my sponsor. I was in a very unhealthy relationship and felt very protective of it and felt like if I told anybody what was really going on, then I might lose it. And I was not willing to do that. So I started to pull away from my sponsor and my friends. I remember driving home one day from work and looking through my phone. I had like 200 plus numbers in my phone, and I felt like there's no one I can call. and walking into my bedroom and sitting on my bed and just seeing so clearly that I had nothing on the inside. You know, it was so clear to me, and that there was no way I was going to be able to stay sober, you know. And my next thought was, but I'm not willing to do anything about it. And that is where I had gotten myself to. And about the only thing I did during that time was say some prayers. You know, that is one thing that I have done consistently throughout my sobriety. And what happened was all of those outside things that I had placed so much dependency on were removed. And I was forced to either really do something different or I was going to drink. I mean, that was clear to me. And I feel like that's when my sobriety really started to change. You know, I really dove into the program. I was going to 2 meetings a day, speaker's tapes in the car. I was picking up the newcomer to go to the meeting. I would read the 7-step 2 or 3 times a day on top of many other things. I was in constant prayer. I was in so much emotional pain that I was literally willing to do anything. And I would read the 7-step like in the 12 and 12 like it was my lifeline, because I related to every single thing in it. And I felt like there was so much hope. Like, you know, I could change. You know, it would be possible. And I didn't have to feel that, you know, utter humiliation, you know, to gain humility. So I did that, and a lot of things started to change. I really started to have a peace on the inside like I'd never had before. And I really felt firm in my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't have any of the outside things that I thought I needed to be okay. And I was okay, and I was happy, and felt a real peace, and I really felt like I had started to develop a relationship with a higher power. And around 7 years, I had started doing yoga a lot as a meditation, as my meditation practice. And I was doing yoga because I was always afraid to meditate. I was so afraid of what would come up. You know, I was just terrified. And some stuff started to come up, and some stuff about my first step started to come up. And it really rocked me, actually, because I was probably in the best spot I'd ever been in my sobriety, and I'm questioning my first step. It was really unsettling. And I had gone to my cousin's wedding, and I had heard, I got sober when I was 20, so I had heard for years and years in AA, normal people don't drink like we do. This, and that. And I'm at this wedding watching normal people drink like I drank, and it really messed me up. I mean, it really messed me up. I really thought, like, normal people never, like, got crazy, but they do. You know, I just didn't have anything to compare it to. And it really messed me up, and that's when I had to go back and write out my first step. And there were some things that I had never told my sponsor, because I thought it would mean I wasn't an alcoholic, which in and of itself is so alcoholic. But, you know, anyway, so I was able to go over that first step with my sponsor, and I'm so grateful, because for a long time I would read certain things in the big book and think that I didn't relate to them, you know. But once I wrote that out and read it to her, I was able to go back into the big book and find myself. And thank God, it's not a comforting feeling to feel like you don't relate to the big book, you know, or to things that people share. But I was able to really relate in at that point. And I feel like it really helped my first step a lot. And also, a couple years after that, I got this ice cream, and it had liquor in it, and I took a big bite. I didn't know, and I had the phenomenon of craving. That was one of the things on my first step, was I didn't remember ever having it, but I definitely had it, and I had the obsession too. So that, out of a not great thing, came a good thing as far as my first step. And I also really started to do something different with my family. At that time, the worst time of my sobriety, my mom had gotten cancer. And And I felt nothing about it. I mean, that's where I was in my sobriety. I had no feeling about it. I felt like the ice queen. And my sponsor told me, she said, you do not want to miss this. You will regret if you miss this. She's like, show up. And I had no idea what she meant. But I was like, okay. So I showed up. I went to her surgeries and her chemo. And, you know, I helped her when her hair was falling out and her wig and all of that stuff. And I showed up and I felt like a zombie showing up. But I did. And something started to shift within me in doing that. And my relationship with my family started to change in doing that. And I had finally gotten to a point where my sponsor said, it's time for you to make a formal amends with your parents. You know, because I had caused so much damage and not changed for so many years into sobriety that to make a formal amends would have been counterproductive, you know. And so she was like, it's time to make amends, and your mom is first on the list. And I was terrified to make amends to my mom. My mom is like a businesswoman. She is a closer. She's very stoic. She does not show emotion. So I was terrified to make amends to her, you know. But I kept trying to make a plan with her where we would be one-on-one. And every time I would make a plan with her, something would happen, and we wouldn't be able to do it. And I would call my sponsor, and I'd be like, I'm trying. Like, I don't know what to do. She's like, just keep trying. I was like, okay. And so, I mean, this had gone on for, like, months, where literally was like, she'd bring my dad to lunch or whatever it was, and I wouldn't have the opportunity to make that amends. And in April of 2008, I got a phone. It was a Friday. I was at the meeting, and I got a phone call from my dad. Sorry. And my mom had a brain aneurysm, and she was in the ICU, and my dad was like, you got to come right away. And so my roommate and I drove down there, and you know, she was in there. She was in a coma, and they hadn't intubated her yet or anything, but she was in a coma, and my dad was just a complete mess. I mean, he was beside himself. He couldn't stop crying. And they really, we didn't know if she was going to live. It was really bad. And, you know, and I walked out of the ICU, and there was like 12 people from the group there. And I felt like really grateful for that. And I just showed up, you know. My dad completely fell to pieces. I mean, he could hardly even show up to the hospital. He couldn't take seeing my mom, who was the rock of the family, so helpless. You know, tubes everywhere, intubated, all that stuff, and completely out of her mind. And you know, it was really touch and go for a couple weeks, and there was a lot of problems. She had so much bleeding in her brain that they couldn't find the source. And so it was just like this wait and see and like plugging holes and just constant like things going wrong, things falling apart. And I just showed up. And someone from Alcoholics Anonymous showed up every day to sit with me so that I could show up for my mom, because I would be there 10, 11, 12 hours a day. And you know, I had to take a month off from work to be there, and I just had to handle everything. And I really believe that if I hadn't gone through the stuff that I had gone through the previous 2 years, I don't think I would have been able to handle it, you know. But I really believe that, you know, God did for me what I could not do for myself. I mean, He really gave me a strength not of myself, and that was very clear. You know, and I just showed up every day, and I was there, and someone was there every day with me, and I can't even express the gratitude that I feel, you know, for the friends in my life. I mean, it's just amazing. I'm so blessed, you know. But she had to have brain surgery, and you know, and she made it through. And then it was just this long road of recovery. And, you know, after she was out of the ICU, then she was in a nursing facility, and she was out of her mind, hallucinating, and just, you know, and I just showed up. And I never thought you know, that I would have to, like, be the mother. You know, I had to change her diapers. I had to, you know, bathe her, all that stuff. And, you know, and I'm so grateful that I got to do it. And that's when I understood what my sponsor said about, you don't want to miss this. You know, I would never give that experience up for anything. You know, and she's doing really well now. But it's been a long road, and at that time I didn't know whether I'd ever get to make amends to her, because she wasn't in her right mind. I mean, she was thinking meerkats were in her car and rivers were running by her bed, and she was really out there from the brain trauma, you know. And so I kind of thought, I didn't know if I would ever get to make amends to her, you know. And probably 6 months ago, I brought it back up to my sponsor and was like, you know, do you think that I could make amends? Would that be appropriate considering her state? And my sponsor said, absolutely. You should absolutely make amends. And so I got to make amends to her, and it was amazing, you know. And our relationship today is amazing. And I love her so much. And, you know, and I really get to show up today for that. And then shortly after that, I got to make amends to my dad, and that was really cool too. And I feel like, you know, I really get to be a daughter today, and that's certainly not how I was for most of my life in sobriety, you know. So I have such a blessed life today, and you know, life definitely happens. I mean, I have had my ups and downs even this year, you know. I had some really great things happen in the last, you know, 6 or 8 months, and I'm so grateful for them. But even with that, you know, I am not fixed. It's like that seventh step again. I keep coming back to it. You know, it's like I started to get these outside things again, and I started to think I'm good, you know, that again. And it's like it says in the seventh step, like, thank God that's over. I'll never go through that again. And it's like, that's exactly what I did, you know. I just started to do the same thing again, where, you know, I was, you know, spending all my time in my relationship and not hanging out with people as much, not helping the newcomer as much, you know, that thing. And not wanting, and kind of knowing it was happening, but not wanting to do something different, you know, until I got again to a place where I was like, I can't live like this, you know. I am miserable again, and you know, and able to take that inventory and bring it to my sponsor, and get some good orderly direction, and get back onto the path. And it's, you know, I feel like in the last couple years, I've learned that, you know, life is not fair. As much as I wish it was, it's not fair, and life happens, you know. And as long as I am plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous, I am working with a sponsor, you know, being of service, helping the newcomer, working the steps, you know, I am able to learn how to navigate life, you know, because, you know, the drink was removed over 10 years ago. Now it's a living problem. Like, how do I live in this world? You know, how do I have successful relationships? I am extremely defective, you know, and I need a lot of help. I am maybe even more help today than I did when I was brand new. You know, and I'm just so grateful, you know, to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be afforded this wonderful life despite myself. I mean, I certainly don't deserve it. So thank you so much for having me, and thank you for letting me share. Mm-hmm.